RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So, to the findings of a study published last month for the Journal of the American Medical Association, which found, are you ready? Are you sitting down? That one in 33 children aged 5 to 8 has an autism diagnosis. And that's even higher than the official figure that we've been talking about and many of our listeners are aware of, especially after our chat with J.D. Handley. One in 36. To talk about this, Dr. Michael Navridakis is back with us on RCR. He's a PhD senior reporter for The Defender, part of the rotation of hosts for CHD TV's Good Morning CHD, based in Athens, Greece. Michael, nice to have you back. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on, Paul.
Stunning, isn't it? It's worse than we thought.
It's absolutely stunning, but at the same time, it represents the continuation of a trend that we have been seeing now for many years. The 1 in 36 figure comes from the CDC. It wasn't too long ago that the CDC was giving us a figure of 1 in 50. Yeah. So from 1 in 50, we went to 1 in 36. Now we have this study, and I'll mention here that the data for this study comes from the health records of over 12 million Americans that are enrolled in various healthcare insurance systems in the U.S. It's a long-term study between 2011 and 2022. So over this period, they tabulated the autism diagnoses, and that's how they came to this figure of 1 in 33 children between the ages of 5 and 8. And they also saw significant increases in autism diagnoses in all sorts of other age and gender categories.
Wow. Okay. Now, in our chat with J.D. Handley, you may or may not be aware of him. He's got a son with autism, and he's made it his life's mission to get to the bottom of that. That he mentioned 30 years ago, 1 in 10,000. Wow.
Absolutely. And the scientists that I spoke to for this study basically pointed at something that, of course, the authors of the study did not point to, and the authors of most mainstream autism studies just, you know, dance around completely, which is that the age groups that we see having the biggest increases in autism diagnoses are the age groups that began to get vaccinated, first of all, when the childhood vaccination schedule in the U.S. was expanded, and second of all, beginning in the mid-1980s in 1986, when the Vaccine Compensation Act was passed that year, which gave immunity to vaccine manufacturers in the U.S. and set up that whole system that we're now very familiar with.
The vaccine court, right?
Exactly, yes, which almost no one can go to, and yeah. It's just, it exists on paper, essentially, and not so much in reality. But since we, for instance, saw significant increases in a study in young adults as well, these were people that were children in soon after 1986. So among young adults between the ages of 26 and 34, there was a 450% increase in diagnoses during the study period. So the scientists that I spoke with really pointed at that date, 1986, as the beginning of this process that sort of set into motion these very rapid increases in autism diagnoses that we see today.
Funny, we see the same sort of connection between rollout of a recent vaccine and excess deaths. So this is a kind of a repeated pattern, if you will. In terms of diagnoses, I mean, I know nothing about autism diagnoses. And back in my day, we didn't know any kids that I can remember anyway, away in it, 1 in 10,000, you wouldn't, who had autism. But is there any, what's the variability? Well, I mean, what is the range for autism? I guess you can have a spectrum, right? They talk about the spectrum, and on one end it's probably mild, and the other is like a friend of mine who's every day since they've had their child, who's now in their mid-20s, has been dominated by dealing with this at the extreme. So is there any information on the actual diagnoses and what is actually autism?
That's an excellent question, Paul. And looking at the data points from the study, we really don't get any sort of information as to the degree of autism that all of these children and young adults were diagnosed with over the years. We don't get some sort of a breakdown. In other words, what percentage had sort of a milder form? What percentage have a more severe form? And it's interesting because they probably do have that data. This comes straight from healthcare systems in the U.S. And the authors, I'll mention, work for healthcare systems. So there's four of them that work for Kaiser Permanente. It's one of the largest healthcare organizations in the U.S. And there was an author that works for the Henry Ford Clinic in Michigan. So five authors out of, I think, the six put this paper together come straight from, you know, this ecosystem, this healthcare ecosystem in the U.S. So it's very likely that they have this data, but chose for whatever reason not to include it in the study. And some of the people that I interviewed for this story pointed that out and said that Congress really should actually subpoena these authors in the journal to get the full data set to see what else is there that we haven't been told.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a comment here, and this is from John Gilmore, Executive Director of the Autism Action Net. The study confirms what we have seen from many other data sources or from many other data sources. There is an ongoing catastrophic epidemic of autism. I can't think of stronger words.
There aren't. And John Gilmore is exactly right. When we're talking about figures like 1 in 33, 1 in 36, we're talking about an epidemic. There's no way around that, even if the authors danced around that word as well. And even if, of course, the entire paper does not have the word vaccine included once anywhere in the paper.
It should be, shouldn't it? Because it's such an obvious, what do they call it, temporal, or there's a word for it, connection. It's, you can't ignore it, even if you don't want to believe it.
It's very similar to another story that I wrote recently, which looked at Guillain-Barré syndrome. And there was a study that was done that looked at the World Health Organization's database to get all of the recorded diagnoses of GBS going back to, I believe, the late 1960s. And what we see is that this used to be a very rare diagnosis. And then there were two very large jumps in the data set. The first one was in right after 2009, 2010, and the second one was right after 2020. Well, we know what happened in late 2020. The COVID jabs were introduced. And we may also remember what happened in 2009, 2010, with that era's, that era's version of COVID, the what was it, H5N1 that circulated at that time. So we see these two very big jumps right around the time that these vaccines were introduced in the past, you know, almost 15 years. And yet that paper kind of danced around it and was saying, well, you know, there may be a connection between vaccines and autism. And in fact, there is a connection between 17 very common vaccines and not autism, GBS, I'm sorry. So there may be a connection between these 17 vaccines and GBS, but we actually still think that factors such as getting COVID or getting the flu pose a higher risk of getting Guillain-Barré syndrome than getting vaccinated. So yeah, they have these results, and then in their findings, they just say something that's entirely opposite.
Yeah, it's what is not said that kind of draws your attention to what's not being said. I see an expert here is saying that that the rise in diagnoses, improved diagnoses, may have contributed to the rise. That can happen. That can happen.
Well, it can happen, but this should be taken with a bit of a grain of salt, according to some of the experts that I spoke with. And several of these experts, by the way, they got into this field of research because they have autistic children. So they're not just looking at this in an abstract sense. They live this every day with, you know, their loved ones, with family members of theirs. So what they were saying is that there's been a tendency, at least in the U.S., in recent years, to make autism kind of almost trendy or fashionable among young people, as it's sort of I've heard it described, for instance, as a superpower. Oh, you know, you have this, you know, these special, awesome superpowers.
Like the guy on Rain Man.
Yes, exactly. Like that. Like, you know, it's this really awesome super thing, and it's not a burden at all, and it's really cool.
I can tell you from personal experience, a friend of mine, it's a burden like you wouldn't believe. They love their children, and that's why they're there. But boy, it's a burden. Oh, man.
Absolutely. That's what everyone I've spoken with that has family members with autism has told me. And it's a lifelong burden. And this is something that these study authors do point out, by the way. And I think they're correct in this in saying that, you know, these children, you know, if we look at the 5 to 8 year olds, for instance, you know, autism's not going to go away. They're going to have this for the rest of their lives. Someone's going to have to take care of them when their parents are no longer able to, because many, you know, in the more serious cases in particular, their parents have to provide them lifelong care until, of course, their parents are no longer around. I did an interview actually with one of the individuals that I quoted in a story, Mark Blacksill, a few months ago, and he was talking about the very urgent need for some sort of a solution to be found for these autistic individuals that are going to eventually lose their parents and family members that can take care of them. Maybe they have siblings, but maybe they don't. Someone's going to have to take care of these people. And that may be why the study was written by these five individuals that come from the healthcare system in the U.S., because unfortunately, what they may be seeing in terms of the future needs of these autistic individuals is dollar signs. You know, they're going to need medication, they're going to need all sorts of treatment and care. And that, you know, a very cynical way of looking at it is, you know, there's money to be made and there's a market there that's going to exist long into the future in terms of taking care of these people.
I'm just wondering, if the dam bursts on this, and it probably will at some point, the liability, the moral issues, number one, the liability issues, the issues of caring and what that costs at that scale of 1 in 36, it's mind-boggling, isn't it?
It's a massive cost. I don't have the figure in front of me right now, but I believe it's been projected to go into the billions of dollars in the future. And what I've been told is that healthcare systems in the U.S. just are not set up at this time to be able to, let's say, accommodate what is going to be the growing number of autistic adults in the future that are going to require care because they've lost their family members that were taking care of them.
But just on a liability issue, with that much damage potentially over such a long time, well, someone has to pay, don't they? There has to be accountability. There has to be justice for those families and kids.
Well, I would imagine so, Paul, and I would think that we might end up seeing something very similar to what we've been seeing during the years of COVID, where we've seen data come out not from, you know, public health agencies, but from private insurers, for instance, showing us with very, you know, hard evidence this increase in excess deaths. And these increases in deaths in, you know, healthy working age population adults, we may end up seeing something very similar come out, not, again, from our public health agencies, not from Kaiser Permanente.
Well, they're kind of liable in a way, aren't they? That this liability must be in that area too. Forget the vaccine makers who have had immunity, but everyone gets hit, don't they?
Well, of course they're going to get hit, but, you know, I would think that public health agencies just see it as something that, you know, they have taxpayer money. They can just use taxpayer money to, you know, sweep this issue under the rug as much as possible. I think, however, that it's going to be impossible to keep this issue under the rug for too long, especially as these figures are going up. More and more people are asking questions. And in fact, this is where I'll point out another story that I wrote recently for The Defender looked at various surveys that have taken place recently in the U.S. and in Canada. A growing number of parents are beginning question the connection between vaccines and autism. There was one survey where the percentage of parents in 2001 that believed there was a connection between the two was 1%.
Right.
But now, depending on the survey, we're getting figures around 27%, 29%, 32%. And that's in addition to the percentage of parents that are on the fence. They're not saying in these surveys that they believe vaccines cause autism, but they're also not saying that they don't. They're in the I'm not sure category.
So they could swing.
They could swing. And if we add the skeptics to the percentage, we're already right around 50%. So there's a significantly growing number of parents of children that are beginning to question this whole narrative that, you know, public health agencies, medical journals, et cetera, are putting out that, oh, it's just increased diagnoses. There's nothing else going on, nothing else to see here. And it's perfectly normal. And autism is this wonderful thing. It's a superpower, and it's not something to worry too much about.
Surely on the basis of this, you'd have to pull the childhood vaccination schedule, wouldn't you? You'd have to at least pause it at this point.
It would definitely have to be quite seriously re-examined, I would imagine, and there would have to be serious studies that will look not just at the impact of any one single vaccine and its connection to autism, but also the interactions between them. In other words, the entire schedule as a whole, or these various combinations of vaccines together that are given at various sort of points in a child's life. These sorts of studies will really probably shed light on exactly what is going on and may confirm, in the end, a lot of what we have been suspecting for quite a while.
Your feeling from looking at the stories, you know, covering it journalistically, is this, well, it feels like a disaster. This could be an epic disaster. Do you think it is? Do you think the chances are that it is?
It is. I mean, look, they're ruining so many people's lives. You know, these children and these adults, these autistic adults, they're never going to be able to have a fully normal life. Depending on the degree of autism they have, they may have a somewhat normal life. They're always going to require some level of treatment. And in more serious cases, a lot of these individuals are never really going to be able to make a living or have an independent existence. So it's a disaster. It's a humanitarian disaster for, you know, future generations. And it's just really, I know for the families of these autistic individuals that I've spoken with, it's infuriating because they've seen the before and after for their children in many cases, they've seen when those symptoms came on, when the onset began. It's absolutely heartbreaking, and they have to dedicate their lives to, you know, taking care of their children and into adulthood. But they're told left and right not to believe their own eyes. And, you know, that has given a lot of these individuals the motivation to try to get to the truth and try to get to the bottom of what is going on. And that's why I think that eventually we're going to see the pendulum swing the other way.
I suppose it's appropriate to end on speculation about RFK Jr. and the influence that he looks like he will have, well, in the health area, let's say, make America healthy again. This could be a moment, a watershed moment coming up with someone like him. I know he's talked about this and referred to this. It looks like he will have quite a bit of say and power in the space. Have you done any thinking about what that could mean?
Absolutely, Paul. What I can say, for instance, is since, you know, for journalistic purposes, I'm subscribed to the mailing lists of all sorts of mainstream sort of like pharma newsletters and so on, because sometimes you get an interesting lead for a story from those newsletters. And what I've been seeing, especially in the last couple of weeks, you know, right in the lead up to the election in the U.S., is a lot of articles that are almost like panicking as the reality sets in that there's a very good chance that Bobby Kennedy is actually going to have a very influential role in the next presidential administration in the U.S. and what that will mean for the FDA and for other public health agencies and, of course, for Big Pharma itself. So I can tell you they're worried because they're not hiding their worry. They're writing about it.
Yeah. All right. Incredible. Thank you for joining us again, Dr. Michael Navridakis, beaming in from Athens, Greece. We're talking about a study published last month for the Journal of the American Medical Association, finding that 1 in 33 children, not 1 in 36, as we thought, aged 5 to 8, has an autism diagnosis. Michael, if people want to go and read more from you on this, what's the best place to go to?
Best place is to go to childrenshealthdefense.org/defender. You could read all of the Defender's stories there. We publish Monday through Friday.
Thanks for coming on again, Michael, and look forward to another chat sometime. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate it.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.